Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, it's Guitar Foundation of America. That's the GFA winner, composer, and guitar manufacturer, Johannes Muller. This is a guy, you know, an actual Renaissance man when it comes to our instrument, our genre. He's just done it. I'm not talking about composing a little bit. I'm talking about an entire album of original compositions. So this is a guy who is contributing to our field in all these different ways, you know, from mastering the instrument and winning what is arguably the most competitive competition for the instrument, going on to compose for the instrument, then going on to build the instrument in China. And, you know, we get into it. He's living out there in what they consider to be a guitar city out in China. And he's part of like this whole thing that's going on over there. It's a very exciting interview. And I know that I can't believe I've never talked to this guy before. One of the, obviously the beautiful things about doing this virtually. Anyway, I'm going to have a little coffee, but this show is sponsored by Mr. Richard Sage and SavageClassical.com. That's right. Just now, just before I started this, I got the email where he was like, hey, how's it going? You know, of course, I'd love to continue sponsoring the show. So we're going to do this for another year. It might be a little bit more because I take longer to get the episodes out, but he signs up for bulk. And absolute honor. I'm just every year I do this and I go like, when is he going to say no? And he said yes again. So it's great to be affiliated with something that we use as guitarists. And that's it. That's kind of where I want to be. I don't make enough money with the other stuff. It's not worth it. So we're sticking with this. This is SavageClassical.com. Go to S-A-V-A-G-E Classical.com and support the show. Make sure you tell Richard that you heard about him on here. So that he feels comfortable supporting the show. He feels like it's worth it. I think he would, I know he likes the show. And so, it's great. At this point, we're talking year 8, year 9. What is it with him? Family at this point, SavageClassical.com. And you know, what an honor. I can't believe that happened in real time. I also got a text here from Verizon saying that my automatic payment was processed. I need to turn on the old do not disturb. I don't need to hear that from Verizon. God, stuff costs so much money, but it's, you know, what are you going to do? You're on your phone all day. You can't, you know, skimp on that. That's something I'm interacting with way too much. Way too much. You know, I did it. I almost had a panic attack. I posted some dumb video. I was like playing with my phone on a rainy day. It was spring break last week. It's like gorgeous right now. So on a rainy day, I'm playing on my phone and I find the little GarageBand thing. I start fiddling around with it and I make up this song. I use some dumb accent, like some, you know, not that these are dumb accents. I'm not saying that. I'm saying my accent probably was just, I was just being silly. It was like a kind of a hybrid between Scotch and Irish. I don't know what it was. And I just made this song called Go Away Boy. On my phone as I was like sitting on the couch, and then I went outside and I filmed this, you know, creepy little weird video of me walking around in a park, and I thought this is the funniest thing I've ever done. This is the work I'm proudest of, just as much as I'm proud of my album or my compositions. The fact that I was able to, you know, whip this up on my phone, I just was really excited about it. So, you know, I sent it to some family members, then I sent it to a friend, and then I sent it to Instagram, and I put it up on Facebook, and I don't know, you know, people are like, my last video was like me with this composition that I'm very proud of, and then my next video is this scary, you know, weird, you know, thing that if you know me, you know that it's I'm being funny. And I thought I was hilarious. So I put it on there. And then I proceeded to, instead of enjoying the video that I made and just sharing it with my friends, I put it on Instagram and I'm glued to the goddamn phone. I'm glued to it. I'm sitting there. I'm looking at it. I'm going like, oh God, do they think I'm weird? Oh no. And on Facebook, it didn't get that many likes. So I deleted it. And then I lost sleep over this. You know, I'm sitting there thinking like, oh, these people don't know me. They're going to think I'm weird. And, you know, what about the job? You know, the whole thing. And it's just, oh my God, I just deleted the apps and that phone is just being put to the side. You know, I can't anymore with it. I will stare at it. You know, I get on there for the New York Times and I end up just watching garbage. You know, I end up looking up how old Tom Hanks is. Just stuff I don't need to know. So it was the spring break was sort of a wet one this time. It's like, I started out a Friday and I went with my friend and my girlfriend to go upstate. We went to, New Paltz, which is sort of a college town. Sorry, I was trying to kill a gnat. You guys get these gnats with all, I got a lot of plants and the gnats are, it's a breeding ground. Anyway, so I went up there and it was raining. Then we came back to New York and it was sunny on Monday. Then I went back upstate. This is upstate New York, right? New York City is at the bottom of the state. And you have to go up, 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 and then you get into the trees. And we went to a place called Saugerties, New York. And it rained the whole time and everything was closed. So there wasn't anything to do but write a song called Go Away Boy. And and then get upset. You know, or fixate on whether this is going to affect my career in a positive way or a negative way. So that was my spring break. And I'm just getting back to it. My head's a little fragmented. I'm kind of all over the place. You know, I had sort of a big Sunday of sort of hanging out and fixating on another issue that I had that I don't even want to talk about. It was just, you know, this is it. This is the last pandemic spring break. And I just said, you know what? Just take it easy. You don't need to travel. You don't need to go anywhere. Just take a little car, go up, get the Airbnb. I did get into a fight with somebody up in Saugerties, and I feel kind of bad about it. I didn't mean to make them feel bad, but they had a dine-in only thing, right? So this thing was like dine-in only. You could get the steak for $15, but you had to eat it in the restaurant. Right? That's totally not cool. So you know, I felt rage, probably rage that had built up because I was fixating on my stupid song on Instagram, right? And then that ended up sort of creating this sort of chasm in me that I could just sort of move the anxiety around throughout my body. And I decided to sort of fixate on this steak special to sort of get my mind off Instagram. So I decide that I'm going to take that anxiety and just throw it at these three nice people working behind a bar. And I didn't, you know, I didn't explode or anything like that, but they could tell that I was sort of that I had a point of view and that it wasn't necessarily a positive one. I didn't yell at anybody or, you know, we still ordered everything. We still tipped 20%. You know, we said thank you. Everything was nice. But I did bring up the fact, and I think I sort of had a little bit of a temper in my voice, I'm assuming, you know, that could happen. And I just said, because the steak is $27 if you eat it somewhere else, if you take it to go. It's $15 if you eat it in there. And I said, you know what, guys, I don't think this is a good idea. This is actually really bad that, you know, I know it's not you guys, but that we're being that dining indoors is being incentivized right now. I don't like that. I'm just letting you know. Maybe that, you know, will start a snowball effect and they'll stop sort of trying to get people to eat inside. So, you know, not aggressively, but just incentivizing indoor dining. Anyway, so it wasn't the best spring break. It was okay. It was all right. I played guitar on Monday. I played guitar on Friday and that was it. And then I only played. I didn't like practice. I sort of just like played it. Hung out with friends, hung out with a brother, played some board games. It wasn't much to do. And then next year, the gloves are off. Who knows where I'll end up? You know, I could be in a jungle. I could be in Europe. Who knows? But right now, let's go to Europe. We're going to go to The Hague, right? virtually in our minds, and we're going to visit Mr. Johannes Moeller. He's going to tell us all about what he's been up to. Make sure you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Some of you have been doing it, never enough. Everybody who does it gets a free copy of the score for Fig Tree that was beautifully, I'm sorry, actually, I said we were introducing Johannes Moeller and now I'm going off on something else, beautifully performed by Damian Kelly. Damian Kelly is a great guitarist, and I gave him this score, and he donated the show. That's it. He donated the show. I gave him the score like I said I would, and within, what is it, a week, he kills it, knocks it out of the park. Damian Kelly from the Red Brick Duo, remember? They were promoting something, and also I interviewed him right when he moved to the city, I think. So it's great to see him grow, and my oh my, performed it better than I could have. So Mr. Kelly, congratulations, and thank you so much. It's an honor. He played that book about the fig tree. And if you donate, you can play it too. I'll send it right to you with the original artwork by Nico Trout. That's Brett Williams. Music.com, B-R-E-T, williamsmusic.com/support. Sorry for the little interlude here. And now, in all sincerity, let's get to it. This is Mr. Johannes Moeller. You brought up sort of your home in China, which is, you know, I don't know if it's a new thing. It said that you kind of, you became the ambassador to that city. Is it Jing'an? Is that the way you would say it?
Yeah, Jing'an. Very good, yeah.
Jing'an, almost.
You're on it. I love to say Chang'an, but it's a Jing'an.
Yes, so Cheng. Yeah, I know that it's that. And actually, you know, if you go to like, and you try to get it pronounced, it sometimes it'll say, it'll say Chang. Like they don't even get it right.
Yeah, Cheng. Yeah, I mean, it is always, it's like my name again. And what I find, I find it also, of course, if you have more famous places, eventually we start saying them in a certain way, like, you know.
Shanghai, we know how to
Paris,
say that.
We say Paris, right? So
right.
We're still to see what Chang'an will have, like, I don't know what its English name, let's say, will be, because it's still a city that is yet to be known to the world, let's say.
Which you're trying to change a little bit. I noticed, you know, on your website, you talk about it. It's even got this giant statue. The whole city is built around, you know, the guitar production.
It's a fairly new city. First of all, we have to understand also with Chinese cities, it's not really the way, it took me a while to figure that out, but they don't organize the cities in the same way as we think of it.
Oh.
It's more like when we talk about Chang'an, for example, that is actually an area. But, you know, it's a fifth-tier city, so that is its city. But within that area, you will have kind of cities or little villages spread out over the whole area, which is quite interesting.
I would assume it's almost older countries have systems that are kind of like that, right, where the sort of the municipalities are very small and compact, just because of the. I'm assuming it's because of the nature of transportation, but with China,
not
it's so probably
sure. It's just about like just the way strike. Because then we have Zunyi, which is the Zunyi city, which is the nearest big city.
That's more famous.
But then the whole area is Zunyi, so I guess it's a bit like you have New York State and you have New York, but.
Then we have the boroughs. Yeah. Then we have the little neighborhoods within the boroughs. But I don't think that, I don't think that there's as much. I don't know. I won't purport to know what I'm talking about at all. As far as Chinese municipalities concerned.
Well, it's a very beautiful area. It's very rural, basically. Yeah. And this place was basically. It's not built out of nothing because there was a lot. There was people there, of course.
Yeah.
And it's actually a very interesting area because you have a lot of minority people. Actually, about 40% of the inhabitants in Chang'an are not Mandarin, but they would be from minority groups. And it was very underdeveloped and to some degree still is, but it is sort of undergoing a sort of development. However, in Guizhou, which is the larger province, so we have Chang'an, we have Sunyi, and then we have Guizhou is the large province. And it's, as I mentioned earlier, it has some of the most unpolluted nature in the world. So, and it's intended to be kept that way. So of although it can it's being developed, it's trying to do it in a sustainable way. And but somehow, oddly enough, guitar manufacturing is something you don't need a lot of space in a way.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah,
it's a very interesting industry that way, and became the perfect match for Chang'an, which is a lot from actually a single individual's initiative. The general secretary of the city, it was her idea, and this is not much. It's less than 10 years of history we're talking about, and where they kind of decided that Chang'an was going to become the guitar city, and then they convinced guitar producers, a lot of them used to be in Guangzhou, and now a lot of them have moved instead to Guizhou, and it is now the largest guitar manufacturing zone in the world.
That's incredible that they were able to do that within 10 years, and especially because there are so many guitars made in China. And are you talking about just specifically acoustic guitars? You obviously have a classical guitar line.
All kinds. I'm very interested in, of course, I find the numbers quite interesting because it tells us something about, you know, what kind of guitar is going to be popular in the future, right? So in China, as it seems, at least for Chang'an, and I think this also goes more or less for the general production all over China, then acoustic steel string guitars will be the most by far.
Yeah.
And then you have also, which is not really a guitar, but it is a guitar, which is ukulele. This is tremendously popular. A lot of ukuleles are made. And then you have electric and classical. They end up more or less the same size.
Oh, that's interesting. That
it is interesting. I think so, but maybe.
No, I do. I do think it's interesting that despite the popularity of an electric guitar, that the steel string guitar is still, you know, I mean, would you say it's like it's got a clear margin of victory?
I think it's on the up. In the US and in the West, we hear a lot of people complaining about, in a way, the popularity of guitar is going down. But of course, it's very much going up. But I think also if you do look at also in America, I think steel string probably is the biggest right now.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think there's a shift. Yeah, I think it's been a shift from electric guitar being like the super cool thing. And now electric guitar is almost like, it almost feels like something from the past.
Yeah, that's interesting. As with the guitar solos being gone. Yeah.
I think the steel string guitar is the new cool guitar. Yeah. And the electric guitar feels a little bit like, oh, that's what my, you know, dad used to think was cool. And that's my theory, at least.
No, there's definitely something to be said for that. Yeah, and also, I live in a pretty cool neighborhood. No one here would ever play a Fender Stratocaster. It's too, you know, you'll never catch them. No way. It's you know.
Yeah, that's almost like collectible stuff now. You know, it almost feels like historical. You can also see those kind of guitars, the electric guitars nowadays. You can see them in museums. You know, it's like, oh wow, and they're vintage guitars.
Yeah, the hollow body definitely is something that people just play, you know, to kind of look cool. But as far as, you know, that sort of trend, do you see that in the Netherlands and in Sweden?
Well, I don't know all the numbers, but I'm ultimately a guitarist, but I I've gotten involved in this kind of whole guitar making, guitar manufacturing kind of whole circus, let's say. And it's one of those things, it's one of those worlds, once you get into it, you can't really get out. So, but I would say from many years back, I would say, yeah, I think that the steel string guitar is the most popular one everywhere, probably.
I mean, I have students that are classical students.
But I don't know. Don't hold me for it. But
yeah, no, I have students that have been playing classical guitar with me for 10 years and just never, you know, I suggested that they buy a classical guitar, but they just never did. They just never got around to it. They just play their silly little steel string. It's like a handful of them. There's not many anymore, but there's certainly when I was younger.
I mean, it was more, I don't know how it's in America, but it used to be that it was very much recommended to start with like a classical nylon string guitar.
Yeah,
and I still think that makes sense. Easier on the fingers. But then you can also, ukulele is also very good for children to start. So, but then, I mean, it's not so advisable to give a kid, you know, an electric guitar with an amp and, you know, they can make all kinds of noise. So, and I, you know, so for that, but I just think that getting a steel, in a way, that's what we maybe associate, you know, you can also just for using strum chords and sing, I guess the steel string is like the best one for that.
As far, yeah,
that kind of percussive that you can strum with a pick, and that, I mean, very popular guitar.
Yeah, I think for, you know, most people that are listening, they probably know this, but I'm sure that there are some that don't. But I guess the idea is that the neck is smaller, so you can drag a pick through the strings quicker,
and which also makes it maybe easier on the, I don't know, on the chords. That's an interesting point. I never thought of that actually.
Yeah, well, the whole design I think is designed so that you can strum it. Whereas, and then if you try to finger pick it, we all know that we, you know, kind of get.
Yeah. You know, the thing, you know, I do play also steel string guitar, actually. And the industry, it gets a little
cramped,
actually. But saying that, we actually made on purpose, I made some steel string guitars that are a little more suitable for classical players, maybe for myself.
Well, let's talk about that. So you, as far as the manufacturing that you're doing, is it is in China, but as far as your, you have a guitar brand. Tell me about that. You know, I've seen it on Instagram and stuff like that. It's so interesting.
Well, it is quite something crazy, maybe you could think. And to be honest with you, it was maybe I could have bought a nice house instead. But instead, which is a sensible thing to do. But I thought that I wanted, well, it's a very long story. And it has to do with that I was very interested in the actual guitar early on, to be honest with you. I still, up until today, I find it super interesting. And I always enjoyed like the instrument in itself. Of course, it's the most important is the music, how we play it. But the instrument, you know, it's like the vehicle. And it started, I would say, this kind of interest already. I had a pretty bad guitar when I started. It was a Japanese non-solid top. It carried me through like, say, 6 months, you know. And then I, you know, wanted a better guitar. And we went to a store with my dad. This was in South, not quite also, in Gothenburg. Yeah, it's actually most part of Sweden is south. Even Stockholm is actually the south part, but southern for us. We went to Gothenburg because they had a very good guitar shop. And I was actually very lucky that I got, actually I was there twice. First, and there was this one guitar that I really liked. And then we came back and tried a lots. But there was one, and it was really important to me. Then what happened throughout my sort of life as a student, partly was that I did a lot of competitions where I also would win guitars, concert guitars, you know, it is quite common. And then I got into that kind of a little bit decadent lifestyle of, you know, going, which guitar is better and getting a little, oh no, this one is better here, this one is better there. And then there grew kind of an appetite for more instruments and to try, you know, what is this guitar like? What is that guitar like? It almost became like a bit of an obsession. And I was kind of obsessed with finding the best guitar, but somehow ended up in a situation where I would, because I would have several guitars, right? Just remember I said some of them had won in competitions. So I could sell one of those and then buy another one, or I could save up more money and buy, you know. And it started to become a small little collection, let's say. So I had this great fascination for all kinds of instruments. And I tried all traditional lattice bracing, double, all the different ones. And so it kind of drew me a little bit crazy. And to be honest, maybe I changed guitars too much. But the fact that I did have so many instruments, it had two effects. One was that I somehow learned a lot about guitars.
Yeah.
And I learned because I also would go very often to makers, their workshops, and we'd talk. And, you know, so I learned a lot, really. And then the other thing I learned was that I became very flexible in being able to very quickly take a guitar and makes it sound pretty good. And then at some point I was very involved. Then I got involved with actually working more closely with a luthier. And the first time I did that in a more, like in the sense that I was more like of an endorser, that was with Kenny Hill.
Right.
And we did that from a near, and I had a beautiful guitar from him that I still have. It's somewhere. Unfortunately, that one got a little damaged once in a trip, but
what year was that awesome. When you adopted the Hill?
I was right at, it was during my GFA tour, so it would be 2011.
Oh, wow.
And this is quite interesting. This is about the same time as I also got involved with True Temperament, mm-hmm. which is a whole other, and this story, it all comes together eventually.
When you got together with True Temperament, was that as a result of your time spent in his workshop? Like, what, I mean, because True Temperament...
This is, no, you're asking the story. This is so complicated, and I even don't understand myself how
I'll let you talk. I don't want to interrupt you because you're doing
like
good.
thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I was with Kenny. We did some great work together. Then eventually I went over to China on my first tour. And I did something. I got in contact with Martinez, which is originally actually a brand registered in Germany. Mm-hmm. Originally it was made in Spain, but then they found that they could make much better guitars by going to China. And anyway, Kenny was also involved in that, but it became kind of a brave thing where I decided I was offered to become then the sort of the brand ambassador of that brand. And it's a good brand for affordable guitars. So it wasn't like working with Kenny where we were focused on this, you know, really concert guitars. This was a much broader, but at that time I was very attracted to that because of the, you know, it was a bigger brand, obviously. So if you make low-end guitars, it's like a pyramid. Most people will only buy the cheap one, you know?
Yeah.
It's like guitar lessons. So many people would take guitar lessons and only less than half maybe stay for next year. And, you know, and then you will have and by the end, it's just people like you and me, you know? You know, so interested to go on. We are a rarity, let's say. So yeah. I was interested in that kind of power of being with a big brand. And my God, it was 3.5 years I worked with them. It was a fantastic time. I did hundreds of promotional concerts all over China, promoting the Martinez brand. And I mean, these were awesome products. It's a very creative, very, very skillful company. So it was a great time. But without, you know, sharing too much information, it was it became a natural thing for me to move on, let's say. And as much as I loved it being with Martinez, or, you know, it was, of course, never... You know, I was just kind of working for them. And then when I came to Chang'an, I was basically offered this opportunity to rather than just represent a brand, I could kind of represent the city, and I could myself involve. And basically, they encouraged me, they basically gave me this opportunity to open my own company there that then, you know, I could start. So I had this option. I could basically start my own brand. And this is a little bit where all of that, you know, the dream for the dream guitar, also this interest in technology like True Temperament, which then eventually Kenny adopted that too, to some degree. But because it's such a new technology and people are so skeptical to this, then it was almost like the only way... I'm very happy to talk about it. This is something I find it really interesting, True Temperament. But anyway, by having my own brand, I could basically be free now to do anything. And we've done some so awesome stuff, like in terms of, like, you know, I could go free, I could be creative with designs, and just like really go for that, like keep that dream of making the dream guitar, you know? And that's also why the brand is also called Sueño Dream, which is also after Barrios on Sueño La Floresta.
Yeah, you just got the tattoo, I noticed. You just got a Barrios tattoo, right?
Well, that's some years back, but it's beautiful. And actually, it's quite the guy that made that tattoo. Uh-huh. He's also made some rosette designs for me.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's very, you know, and you, because, you know, it's very hard with guitar design. Of course, classical guitar is pretty conservative, especially compared to steel string or electric guitar. You can do almost anything, but classical guitar is pretty conservative. So we don't have a lot of areas. We don't want to go out too much into the top and so on and do anything. We don't want to do any crazy inlays on the fretboard. Then it doesn't seem like a classical guitar anymore somehow. But the rosette is perhaps the rosette and at the bridge, maybe at the top of the head. Those are the spots that we can go a little bit crazy with. So I just have, over the years now, I have had different designs created for me. You know, but not by people who make rosettes. It would have been, you know, like a tattoo artist made one. We've had minority silversmiths from Guizhou out in the villages. You know, they have hundreds of years of tradition of making jewelry for the women made by Miao minority people. And I mean, this is just an incredible handcraft, and it takes a long time. And so, and I have had them do designs of the rosette in silver, things like that, you know, that I could not have done. I could only do that if I have my own brand. Only if I'm responsible, nobody would allow me to do that. It's too risky, I guess.
I think you're right about the rosettes. I don't think that enough attention is really paid to them. They've always been, they were definitely, when I was a child, the first thing I gravitated towards. You know, I was like, what is this beautiful design? And the rest of the guitar is, you know, especially with classical guitars, oftentimes can be kind of utilitarian. With the exception of, as you're saying, the headstock often,
yeah,
you know, in the 80s and stuff. But the rosettes, I think, you know, that would be almost, I always kind of likened it. I saw somebody in a guitar sort of festival thing in Woodstock where there were just a lot of makers, not really classical makers, but there was one classical maker and he was making his rosettes very interesting. He had fish and all sorts of things like that. And it's sort of, this was years ago, and I was reading Game of Thrones at the time. And I remember everybody's sword had like a sigil on it or something. And I was like, why don't we do that? Why don't people know that, like, oh, that's Johann's, that's the Muller's sigil on that guitar. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like you're saying, sort of the fascination with the technology and not only that, but just sort of with the nerdy sort of artistic process, you know, of making an instrument.
Well, the technology, of course you can, but typically a rosette, like we are used to in classical guitar, is made with lots of little bindings of wood, right?
It becomes
kind of like a long sausage that you then, you cut, like kind of slice it, let's say, like a salami, you know, and then you have 100. And that's still how it mostly is done. And of course, that is a lot of interesting ways you can create. But there are also other ways where you can individually just make each rosette, which is a lot of the wood rosettes we do are just done that way with inlines. Each one is made individually. And then you have, but saying that, if you go back a little bit, especially in the beginning of the 20th century, you know, Barcelona and Spain, Italy too, they did do very fancy rosettes, you know, and not to talk about the Baroque guitar. If we go back, it was very, you know, would look like a wedding cake. But I mean, even classical guitars were made, you know, with mother of pearl and things like that, which I think is really pretty, but then that kind of came out of fashion. But of course, I mean, even in America, you're used to it because Cordoba has adapted that type of pearl rosette, right? In America, the Cordoba.
Yeah, definitely. Within the last 10 years.
Very much inspired by the, I would think, from the design of sort of 1920s, somewhere over in Spain or something like that, that when they did that. And it's beautiful. And I mean, it's one of those things. It's changed a lot over, if you look historically, there's been a lot of changes in them. And they've been sometimes, and some have made them very thin, and some have made them very wide. You know, all of this, this is part of the design, you know, it really is. And I enjoyed the fact that, I mean, although I'm like, it's not that I'm designing them myself, but I'm enjoying that process of being, you know, actively engaging people in designing new rosettes and doing new things.
Yeah, like you said, your tattoo artist is also a rosette designer as well. So that's...
Well, now he is. I made him one. So, you know, that's, you know.
Now, yeah. When you
the
make
body art, guitar this art.
Is, as far as your guitars, are they consumer guitars or are they concert guitars?
Well, we have I have something called, which I actually started. So that's maybe my greatest passion and maybe that thing that will never... I mean, these are expensive guitars. They're called Swenio Limited Edition. Mm-hmm. Like I'm talking, we have guitars made with, you know, silver engravings mm-hmm. and things like that. Like this latest one I made, that we made in that series, that is a fantastic instrument. It's also made with just absolutely immaculately fantastic wood. You know, I hand-picked myself Swiss spruce wood mm-hmm. that is grown, you know, in exactly the right altitude where you have a microclimate. What you want basically is... If you have very even years, if in 120 years, about at least 100 years, you have very even winters. This you only get in the Swiss Alps or in the Alps, you know, it could also be in the Italian side.
Oh, wow. So that's interesting. So you want to be in a climate where you know what the temperature is going to be like all the time. And it's like that consistently. So
you want
the wood
a consistent winters, yeah, basically, so that it right. grows. If you look, evenly. Then you see the year lines. I mean, this wood that it is crazy. I never see. I mean, it's almost like it's not hardly any of the yellowness. It's almost like a white. And this beautiful. Wood is also cut in accordance with the moon cycle. And a lot of people go like, wow, that sounds far out. You know, like that sounds like an overpriced story, you know, that I'm trying to sell you. But it has to do with, it's also scientifically proven. And it is quite significant that the moon affects the amount of water that is in the tree. So the same like the ebb and flow. So you want to basically cut the tree when the moon is as low as possible, as small as possible. Then there is very little wood, less wood. In the trunk. Does that make sense?
Less wood in the trunk or less
water? No, less water. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yes, no, it's okay. We want a lot of wood in the trunk.
We want a lot of wood, yeah. And you have to, and it was interesting about this. This is probably exactly the same kind of processes that was used, for example, by Stradivarius. You know, he would have fetched this kind of wood from the Italian Alps, you know, which is just around the corner from where I got mine. And it's, you know, when I, that particular top, when I took it up and I, you know, do the tapping, it was just like, bing, it almost had like a ring, like almost had a note to it. And when I finally got the guitar, which has been done by just the kind of the best people I can find, it was, just, I just could recognize immediately that ring in the sound. And I mean, this wood is, it's something. It's out of these trees that they cut like this. This is, there's the kind of master grade plus, right? And there's so few pieces. So even within the one tree, you will sort of have the best part of it. You know, like it's not that the whole tree is all good, right? There will just be certain. And that if you go there, you know, you go there yourself, then they allow you to kind of handpick those kind of rare pieces. But of course, it is very limited because
this is a limited series, yeah.
Yeah, but then we do, the Swenio series is coming out in three models. We basically, we're doing one, which is more of a traditional guitar, fan braced and beautiful guitar, but all with true temperament, which we haven't spoken about yet. I'm doing that on purpose, keeping that anticipation. What is true temperament? Well, we'll get to it, maybe we won't,
because there's so much here mm-hmm. to sort of unpack. And
it's a whole journey. But anyway, we are doing I'm focusing now. I've made three models, which is. So there's one more traditional, then we have one which is lattice braced.
And I just want to, I want to remind people of the mm-hmm. fact that, you know, we had Guitar Salon International on, mm-hmm. You know, like probably 6 months ago, and they were talking about guitars. They have the Cordoba brand. That's mm-hmm. they manufacture those now. So the thing is, what's different here is that this is a GFA winner. Who has played every guitar, you know, and played it well and played it at the highest level. So what you're looking for, this is an unprecedented situation. And so, you know what I'm saying? Like, it is an interesting, I don't think it's just somebody who's pushing guitars. And like you said, you could have bought a house and you could have kept on concertizing and that could have been the end of it. But your love for the instrument has taken you here. So I think it's a very unique situation. Anyway, I you know, go on.
No, thank you.
Before we talk about the consumer level guitars.
Yeah. I really appreciate you saying that because of course it's been there are days when I think to myself, why?
Yeah.
It's, you know, and you know, a guitar, it is so complicated. There are if you look how many little parts there is in the guitar and how every part almost comes from a different place in the world.
Yeah.
We don't think about that a lot. So what we then also when we talk about, I mean, what a lot of people, what a lot of manufacturing can do is, for example, you can have parts made, for example, in China or anywhere else, and for some assembly in USA. But for me, it was the choice was to assemble it because that's where I had the opportunity. And that's where I have found the really skillful makers that are willing, you know. China is an amazing place because it's just been bubbling and guitar is kind of growing day by day there. And all of a sudden, we just see this huge culture of making guitars, which basically maybe 80% or more of all guitars in the world are made there. Of course, we think of cheap guitars, but because of that whole environment, it has brought in this kind of interest, and you have this, you have a whole set of young, amazing luthiers that are just, you know, willing, you know, to just do stuff, which is so awesome.
How many people are involved in the process of making a limited series guitar? Is it one luthier, one guitar?
Well, this is a, of course, and a lot of people have this romantic idea about the luthier. And of course, it is important. But yeah. To begin with, we must remember, like I said before, the guitar is had many different parts, all right? And they come together. And actually, part of the magic, of course, which the luthiers talk about is, you know, choose the right wood. Okay, of course, part of it, you look at it, of course, how it matches, of course, how it goes. But this kind of feeling of that. And of course, it's about good wood, good construction. Now, the Chinese, I never met a Chinese luthier who is just one, like in America, for example, the traditional thing is you go to a guy's workshop, it would just him. And he's all alone there, right?
Yeah.
This you don't see in China. There will be like, and I think this is more like it was, for example, and I'm sure Stradivarius had it like that.
He had 700 apprentices. Not 700, but, you know, yeah, he had a team.
That's culture, of course, it has to do with that it, wages are cheaper, of course, in China. But it's also cultural. I noticed that with the Chinese. They don't, the idea that one person is locked up in a room, you know, the Chinese are like most Asians, they're social.
Right.
Do not want to be one person in a room. That almost seems like some sort of. So they will. The typical thing is the master luthier, with his, you know, apprentices. How do you say that in English?
I don't know. Apprentice. I don't even know.
The works with him, and of course, that's also part of why it develops so well. Because what happens is these guys work with a master luthier, right. Then a few years later they have a fight, and that guy starts his own workshop. So it kind of starts very quickly. This knowledge is very quickly spread, and so the you know, some part. This is a little bit, you know, why it's secret. I was going to say, but my limited edition guitars. It's a little secret because I don't also know it all, because right. Like what I do, I source the very best. So, you know, I will see what they do and what they do best, and I don't go in and mess a lot. And actually, a lot of them, they also don't really like when it comes to double tops. There's most double top makers, they won't really tell you exactly what they do.
Yeah, that's their secret. Yeah. So, and also you're just there to try out the guitars too and make sure that they're up to concert level, that this is something that someone could go to a competition with and theoretically win.
Oh yeah. No, I've been just lucky to meet, basically right. I worked with two extremely fine luthiers. And is one guy is Yu Xingping has made, I worked with him. There was the first one when I came to China in to Chang'an. He's just like me. A lot of what happens with Chang'an, because it is the guitar city, it's become one of these places where a lot of people there's a lot of benefits if you want to go and work there, if you want to set up your workshop there. Compared to Guangzhou, of course, everything is much more affordable, but you get also, you know, like subsidies on electricity, on costs, because they want to encourage you to go there and set up a workshop. So Yu Xingping, he had came there and it, a little bit earlier than I had arrived there. So this was a very happy to meet him. I mean, I think that he makes, in my opinion, some of the best double tops in the world.
Yeah.
And that's a lot to say because I'm, you know, but, you know, I'm not trying to say that just because.
When you do the double top, are you doing spruce and spruce? Or are you ever mixing in cedar? Or are you exclusively alpine?
Okay. You can do any of those versions. Yeah, my favorite personally is to mix.
Yeah.
I love that. Of course, what you put on top gives the most character. My favorite. I like to have spruce and then cedar. But I also have another guitar with cedar on top, which is also awesome. But then anyway, we did the Cayman. But Xu Jinping, the thing about him, he's a player himself. He takes, you know, they're truly limited. He really takes a long time to make these guitars. And we do things, which I'm very big fan of. It's to do, you also French polish on the inside. But that is, you know, literally double work, you know. So that is, and French polishing is already the most
when you're French polishing, yeah, it is. I have one in it. It's a disaster. As far as, but the inside of the guitar, I love it because it's so good. Well, but after a couple of years, you have to get it redone and stuff. But the inside of the guitar having that French polish, is that creating a more kind of reflective chamber? What's that doing?
Some people say that it creates more even sound. My theory is that it just makes it more beautiful. I don't know how to explain that. Yeah. French polish to me makes the sound more beautiful and more. And now saying that, we also have used, I've also, there's, it's not French polish, it's not everything. In some cases, which we know also from like Simon Marty, for example, have also came out with guitars with a kind of different, which is not quite a French polish, and it just sounds amazing. So, you know, we also done guitars that are not, but most actually I'm losing track. All right, French polish on the inside. Why would you do that? And a lot of people are skeptical because they just think it's a waste of time. I have every time. I mean, if you think Fleta, he did that, for example.
Huh.
You can see it in, and it's kind of an, I don't understand why it didn't catch on because you don't see it, but you can hear it.
Yeah. Yeah, if Fleta did it, you should do it.
Right, exactly. That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, you look at the best guitars in the world. What are they doing?
Now, again, it might also depend on the guitar. It might depend on a lot of things. So I cannot say that as a fact. But I like that. Anyway, we should probably. I mean, now we're talking a lot about
music. Yeah, well, we definitely get because we don't have that much more time. But
no, and what about your temperament? Maybe people have to look somewhere else for that.
Well, actually, why don't we do that real quick before we go on to your,
that's another.
What has to be a little bit about your music.
No,
what
I
is,
know.
What is
well,
it?
Let's
what,
talk
what is,
about true temperament then.
True temperament as opposed to equal temperament.
All right. Of course, in practice, we know that too. That even a piano tuner, it's not. Like it's just purely mathematically even. They do it by ear, so they end up with something that is beautiful.
Right.
Now, getting to the poor guitar, people go, but it's equal temperament. All the frets are straight and they lined up well. And that was also, you know, from my thinking, that should have been correct when I first came, you know, to think about this. But saying that, me, like many others, when I got to new true temperament, I was already very concerned. I was working a lot with compensations on the nut and on the bridge, both actually. A lot of people do it on the. So I was very aware of, for example, the G sharp on the third string. It's just very, very out of tune, really. I mean, right. And that has to do with we have an action on the string to press down to the fretboard. And then you would think, yeah, but it's all the same. No, the weird thing, here's the thing, that each string has different weight. If we put this guitar that had all six E strings, all the same string, then it wouldn't be a problem because it affected in the same way. But because it's so different weight in each string, this makes a mess. So
wow,
we get, in the guitar, we get something which is its own temperament, all right? Yeah. Which is slightly off, basically. And we get used to it. And I mean, to a sense, it's nothing wrong with it. But it does make it, generally speaking, if we have open strings towards something in the higher position, which I love to do in my compositions, for example, or something like La Cathedrale by Barrios, you have an open B and you actually have very high notes, 12th, 14th, right? Ninth position. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard. If that is in tune, it's not going to be in tune in the first position. So this is a system that compensates for this. So that is a little bit of... So basically what they did in the beginning, they had like a fretboard that like every string had a tiny little fret and they were all kind of like, you know, like little...
Right.
And that is... But then the conclusion was, which is really the true temperament invention, is more the technology of actually creating a fret which is not straight. So that you can, so it doesn't feel weird. It just feels like one fret, but it's bended. So it looks a bit like you took some acid and now everything is not quite
not supposed to be. Right. And that's the way it looks on, is this on your guitars? You're incorporating this?
Yeah, basically on that's one of the things that I just think it's, and a lot of people are very, can be very kind of confused about this. I just think it's just better. It's just a little more beautiful. Just like French polish is more beautiful than a... This is one of those things that, yes, it makes the guitar... It just makes it a little better, in my opinion.
That's great. And you didn't... Who developed this? And when was this first developed?
Yeah, it was invented by Anders Tidell, which is a, like me, Swedish... so that's kind of an interesting coincidence. It's interesting because actually I first got to know them, that was from one of their kind of guy that worked for them in America. So it wasn't actually, the connection wasn't actually Swedish, but it happens to be a Swedish invention. But you know, in Sweden we like to be a little eccentric and you know, you have very cold winters. So Anders, you know, people like him, maybe we have more of those, but you have those everywhere. It's just kind of this kind of mad genius person that decides to go to the bottom of getting a guitar in tune.
Because the winters are so cold, you guys are just stuck inside and there's nothing to do but figure out the fret problem from 1,000 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm glad he did. And it's, I mean, saying that there's other people who have made similar fretboards, as I said. But what's, again, is a little bit special with true temperament is we're not exactly, so it's not exactly equal temperament.
Right. Right.
It's basically starting point, because it's not something, whatever you do with a theory, the reality is surprising you. Yeah. This is the problem with this, because you can try to think a million times and then you put it in practice and it doesn't work. That's basically what happened with normal frets. So
basically
ultimately
what you're doing...
he has measured each and every note against each other and he's created something which is just like on the piano, you make it a little bit more beautiful. It's not exactly equal temperament. It's something a little bit more suitable for the guitar. Let's say it that way.
Yeah,
so that was a semi-short version of, but now we did talk about it. I'm glad we got to.
No, that's
but it
good.
Has changed my life. I enjoy, it's like, you know, I always been interested in guitars and I always loved new things. But this now, the last few year now, and I'm really focused on playing this, it's really been a fresh air for me to really finally get to use this on high-end guitars and enjoy it. It's personal enjoyment more than anything.
It sounds amazing. And that's really what it comes down to with this brand and what you're doing with it is it's personal enjoyment. And also maybe
sounds
someday
very risky, you know.
Maybe someday we'll he's doing it for personal
would
enjoyment.
Would you like to invest? Like, no, absolutely.
Of course
not.
I would. Yeah, the fret thing? No, I'm okay.
No. But,
no, I'm just joking. I do want to do the fret thing because it would be really fun to play a G on the 15th fret and be able to play, you know, a G, you know, mm-hmm. on the third string and have it be in tune. That would be a unique experience. It'd be something I've never quite had before.
We have to, there's a lot of opinions. I made a really good bragging. I made a video where I do short bits of the pieces we know with and without. So there, it exists on YouTube. And if somebody really wants to hear the difference, you know, you can really hear it. I mean, it's subtle, but it's there. And what happens more to me than more than anything, I feel that it just, everything is a little bit more focused.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when you, especially when you go back to using normal frets, it's just intonation-wise, it's just all a little bit uneven and it gets a little bit unfocused. And it's something about, especially for people who just really used to, especially to listen to piano music, then all right. of a sudden it becomes, oh, even, it's funny, you know, I play some pieces by Sor or Giuliani, a lot of, you know, C major and stuff like that, first position, going to E very... All of a sudden, I'm playing it on True Temperament. In my meaning, it sounds more like serious music now. And yeah. part of it wasn't that Sor was not such a good composer. It was more that when we hear it on the guitar, especially a lot of that first position, you know, it just doesn't sound as serious. That if you play it on the piano, it just sounds so clean and in tune. So yeah. it especially with classical music, I think this makes more sense than anything. And you will play, you know, even simple stuff can just sound much purer, let's say.
Yeah, it's I think it's a super important thing. And it's something that I think, you know, I think what you and I will have to admit is that we as guitarists just kind of gave up on it. We were just like, it's just sort of the charm of the instrument.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't have to be that way. The violin could have said the same thing, mm-hmm. but they, you know, they did as much as they could personally mm-hmm. to make sure that everything was you know, in tune on their instrument. And I think we can, as fretted instruments, it comes down to sort of a technological issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really Absolutely. Good that you're addressing this, being who
you are. No, and you can see there's also very interesting developments when you do with 7-8 string guitars, then actually right. becomes even more important, because anyone knows that if you're dealing with multiple guitars, the problem of playing your low notes over the high ones, then it becomes even more noticeable. So
right. It certainly does.
If you play with something like a violinist, well, if you play with a piano, then it becomes all of a sudden way better. But if you play with the violinist, they are used, most violinists are trained to intonate like equal temperament with a piano, right? So they're more used to that. So they struggle a little bit when they have to, then it's almost like they have to intonate in another temperament, which is not piano, which is guitar, which is also unpredictable, because the problem with the guitar temperament that we call guitar temperament is that you do different notes on the different strings. So it's not a consistent, like if the guitar really had its own temperament, but it was consistent, then I think it would be different.
Right.
Too much talking about this true temperament. But, okay. You know, getting to writing though, I must say it is very interesting for me as a writer too, because I pushed a lot of, I use very high notes, very low notes.
I wanted to talk about that actually. Yeah, the Eternal Dream, your 2018 album features, what is it, 9 original mm-hmm. compositions by you. That's incredibly rare for people of your caliber to compose, certainly to the degree of making an entire album. It just doesn't happen that often. So as far as that's concerned, though, the first track off of it sort of applies to what we're talking about, A Star in the Sky, A Universe Within, which I listened to yesterday. That is in and of itself is a track that sort of utilizes the entirety of the guitar from the high end of the fretboard to the low end. You're kind of all over the place. So I can imagine sort of the immediacy of this issue affecting you as a composer. And how that kind of probably, you know, made you so passionate about it, about incorporating it into the making of your guitars. But
it's, I think if I wouldn't be a composer, perhaps I wouldn't be as keen with it. But thank you for saying that. Well, you know, actually what with me was that I started composing at a quite early age. And I had a kind of dilemma, especially kind of in my early teenage year, whether I was going to go more into composing or more into guitar playing.
Yeah.
So I was kind of going back and forth for the longest time. And then at some point, I really decided to really try to really go for the guitar. We talked about the Royal College of Music. Right. Those were the years when I was really, really focused. You know, I was practicing the whole time. It was something that cannot do only one of them. It has to be both.
Yeah.
And it just, I'm not happy otherwise, let's say. You know, I need So being creative is so important to me. Doesn't mean that I'm always writing a lot. Of course, if you're just a writer, of course, you have more time to just focus on your writing. Right. I'm also a player, so there's a balance, and it's important to keep that balance. But I, for me, the Eternal Dream album, it's like these are really some of my most personal compositions. And unlike a lot of albums that I did before, that would be kind of all the music would have been written in about the same time. This actually, the and some of the music that's on that album I had written more than 10 years earlier than I recorded the album. So that was, so it's, let's not say the best of, but until now, the best of. Well,
yeah, that's all.
I hope there's more. But I think, and the Star in the Sky, of course, has been one of those pieces that a lot of, I mean, I get a lot of people that, that comment on that piece. And me, myself, I mean, I, it is, it's one of those things that I think, how did I do that? You know, it just turned out so kind of sparkling. Yeah. And of course, I kind of know how I did it. But more than anything, I wanted to write, this is for a long time, I wanted to write a piece about, you know, this thing which most, we all experience that. You're looking at the stars. It's kind of a very, you can experience that early in your, as a child, I think, this kind of, wow, you know, what is that? When you see the stars, there's something very universal about that. And we know that, you know, people wondered and made up all kinds of theories what it's about, you know? And even now, if you're into science, it doesn't make it any less overwhelming to learn how many thousands of light years and so on you have. So to write a piece that would you kind of transmit that was one something I really wanted to do. And it wasn't like I was very, very, I knew I wanted to do it. And at some point it just kind of came together into that piece. Of course, there's a little bit of flamenco there. I use, you can hear some kind of, but still it just kind of, I still don't really know how I did it. It just, it's, I'm happy about that piece. And you're right too. I think it's sometimes it is like that. We look back on works, and especially if you play them a lot, they, your relation to them changes.
Yeah.
Like, and now it's right. Like, now it's, now it would be very hard for me to kind of try to reproduce how I would go about writing a piece like that, because, and also it's, it has become, started to mean so many other things too, because now I played it to so many concerts and other people have played it. So my own kind of idea about it is also changing, you know. But that album is, it's about that sound, the Eternal Dream. The, I also have a, it's an Eternal Dream is a piece on there, which is very, it's extremely simple, actually, a lot of it. Like Eternal Dream, it only has two bass notes, which is E and D. And that's actually where the title came from, Eternal Dream. There's an E and there's a D. Just are the only two bass notes used in the entire piece. And, you know, so, but it's about the sound. It's about sort of finding themes, finding sounds that I feel really spoke to me, you know?
It's difficult with the guitar. I find that too, sort of the sort of homogeneous bass notes that we work with, it's just easier to work with E, A, and D and to sort of compose pieces that are in E, A, D, or G.
Well, actually, this was funny. In this piece, what I did, I tuned the fifth string to E.
Right. I never thought about retuning the guitar when I was composing because I didn't want to make it. I just never liked messing with the guitar. I never liked approaching pieces and having people tell me, hey, you got to completely, you know, I'm like, did you even write this?
No, I mean, I do so many retunings that sometimes
but I'm now a I'm starting
victim
to think,
of that. No, I can be a victim of that. I mean, talking about true temperament, the guitar can still go out of tune.
Right.
I'm a big victim of sometimes over speculating or overdoing that by retuning too much. So,
but I think it's a good idea because it's the only way to do it. You need to have those open notes in order to play the guitar like a guitar. If you, I tried to write stuff that was like in, you know, B flat and stuff when I had a quartet. It was really difficult to play, first of all, because it's all bar chords everywhere, if you're going to have any. And, second of all, there just wasn't, I felt like I was sort of pretending the guitar was a different instrument, whereas retuning it, now as I'm sort of maturing as a composer, I can sort of see how alternate tunings is sort of the secret sauce when it comes to making the guitar breathe and be able to do what it does well with those open notes.
Well, it's not like every piece that, of course, you have to think. So when you start using different tunings, right, then you have to, of course, the standard tuning is one of them too, of course, which I also love. And I mean, of course, for some things, especially if it's an E, you know, it can be very, like you say, it's very, very lovely. But for me, using the retuning at some point as I was developing, like writing and you know, it became a really important way for me for two reasons. And one was because I was basically looking for particular sound. I kind of knew what I was looking for in terms of sound. And I had a lot of ethnical influences, so I was influenced a lot by instruments that would have a lot of resonating strings. So I started writing very modal music. So if you write modal music and you wanted resonance, the best way is you tune, make sure there's at least no open string that doesn't fit in the mode, for example. Then like, I mean, I was very inspired by Koyum Baba by Carlo Domeniconi.
Yeah.
I think it's the first piece that was sort of accepted into the repertoire with a piece that was so retuned, you know, every string, you know. So that was the first, and that opened a lot of doors for me. So there was two things. So one thing is looking for that sound, all right, and especially like a lot of my, there's another, you talk about Eternal Dream, that one has quite a lot of retunings too. But in my album called India, I'm looking even at the more.
2016. Yeah. That probably was the jumping off point for all this sort of thought.
Well, actually, I'd done some of it before, but the Indian music was a little different because here I was trying to work with the Indian ragas, the Indian scales. Mm-hmm. And it, for me, basically the key to be able to find a satisfying way of use these scales for me was retunings. And oddly, I have a few sets there that work very well, but generally I tune the first string to D for ragas, you know? So I have, and then the low to D too. And then, for example, if you have a more minor style raga, you can tune to B flat, the second string, for example. So, and actually, interesting enough, I didn't know that, wow, but I came to know that the Indian slide guitar, on Indian slide guitar, they came up, it's basically a modification of the Hawaiian guitar, right? That was done in India and popular in Bollywood films in the 70s. And they came up with a way of playing raga on this instrument. One of the tunings was identical to the one I had came up with. So it seemed that more than that I was very clever, it was more like this seems to be just a better way, a way that was very suitable for playing ragas.
Yeah, like you're saying, the B flat, I never would have thought that. A tuning.
Well, if you so if you flat, have
this, it's so obvious. It's like,
well, right, and there, then if you have another, if you have a more, because like, so if you have a D tuning, the B flat, then you get automatically, like, I mean, not that ragas are minor or major, but they have,
yeah.
But you could have, you know, in many of them would have like a minor feeling. So then, like, Rag Kirvani is the one I used for my composition, The Night Flame. They're tuning to the B flat. I mean, it's just wonderful. And then I can use all this campanella, and it was like a new instrument. So that was one thing. And then another thing for me at some point, retuning was very important, because I had, I started a composition quite a bit, and I did a lot of academic studies of composition. And I had written quite a lot of actually music, also mostly for not for guitar. But it became an overthinking process, right? This is, I know a lot of people, it happens to them. It's, of course, I don't discourage you if you study theory, composition. All of this is wonderful. I'm very grateful I did it, because I have it now in me somehow. But at some point, it was like I had learned, I needed to forget about it. Because if you become too stuck in your mind, and it's not emotional anymore. And for me, using retunings was a bit like, now I didn't really know which notes there were. So it kind of helped me to be more creative.
Right.
Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense, because that is, I think, what the academics have lost, mm-hmm, is sort of like a connection with just, there's no way that the first piece that, an atonality, a serialist listened to and fell in love with music over was another,
right,
piece, was another serial piece. Yeah. It's no way. So it's just like, I think sort of, any way, whether you're performing or composing or doing anything, to get in touch with what made you like what you're doing in the first place is always the best meditation before you do anything.
Sure. Well, oddly enough, when I was a child, though, when I was younger, I started actually kind of composing already since I was about 12, really, which is kind of unusual. But when I was a kid, I really enjoyed atonal music.
You like Wozzeck stuff? What are you talking about?
All of the Ligeti, all like, I liked writing music because it felt like you could just do anything.
You could do anything. I guess that is the inspiration of it for sure.
No, and I mean, I know for a lot of people it can be harsh, but I think, again, a child's mind is different because we don't have as much to compare with. And, you know, if you for kids, sometimes contemporary music can be very fun because it's so kind of out of, it's so crazy and so unexpectable. And,
yeah. You know,
and to just go like,
I've never thought about that.
No, really interesting.
Yeah.
So actually, oddly enough, from when I used to enjoy a lot. So I wrote a lot of atonal music, but then then came to modality, let's say, as my, and I came, because I came to ethnic music, basically.
Right.
And that was... Yeah. It was a huge interest of myself. I also, you know, did some studies with Dusan Bogdanovic, and he's written about it too. He wrote a books about that too. It was very helpful. But just in general, for me, the guitar, like, it's all over the world, and you have cousins like the sitar, or you have the oud, and you have all these different instruments that are basically the guitar. And because we play it with nails, we are very easily can imitate these sounds. And right. The guitar is like a parrot a little bit. The guitar can imitate very well. That's my opinion.
Yes, yes.
So going into, and then now we talked about Indian style, of course, but then, of course, what became my really, and this goes before we talk about the guitars that I make in China, my actual real love with China was by working with the Chinese music. And that's also what made my name in China, that gave me. So actually the real first connection with China has to do with the Chinese music, and a huge interest in trying to adapt that onto the guitar. And to be honest, I think maybe more than Indian music, and a lot of these pieces, I don't even have to reach you.
Yeah.
I can very, the guitar can, it's, the guitar is so suited because Chinese music is truly melodical. It's very soothing. It's very harmon, you know, a lot of pentatonic scale. Of course, it can be very dramatic if you listen to pipa music, have those. But as a general thing, the Chinese music is, you know, because of the pentatonic nature, maybe because the nature of their language, the way their songs are composed, it's very gentle, very smooth, very, very heartbreaking, beautiful. Which is, think about it, what better instrument can do that than the classical guitar?
But not, yeah, in the Western world.
The sweetness of the tone. Yeah, I mean... So for me, the guitar and Chinese music has been a beautiful, beautiful meeting. And it felt, you know, I came to China and I realized so many kids and people are interested in guitar and classical guitar. Also, we talked about steel string, etc. But we must realize that the classical guitar in China is huge. It's a big population. And the interest is enormous. And that's kind of, but they're all interested only in the Western music, you know, in the class. And the problem for the guitar in China, from what the missing link, in my opinion, was, okay, it's not okay. It's one thing, all the people that play it, all the kids that learn classical guitar, they love it, you know. But what about the other people? What about their parents? What about like the general audience?
Right.
The connection there, which I think I was very successful with, was to take Chinese music. And now we don't just, originally I started with more traditional music, but now also taking modern melodies and whatsoever, and incorporating that on the guitar. And all of a sudden I felt that it could reach more people. And we really did in China, because I did, not to brag, but actually a lot of people would not want this kind of tours that I did, because we didn't just go to the big cities. We went to cities where people like hadn't seen a foreigner before, you know. So it was already, you know, children would be like crying, you know, because they never saw it. No, no, it's true.
Yeah.
Sometimes you had kids that, or we have some workshop or something that they didn't dare to, you know, they thought I was some kind of ghost.
Monster. Yeah.
And I played, you know, I played for people who never heard really classical guitar before. But they would come hundreds of them. This is what you don't realize. The curiosity was huge. So in China, you can very easily get an audience. But the question is, are they going to like it? Because they might come. So this was my key. You could get the people, but now it was my job to try to play them some music that they would really appreciate and then make them appreciate the instrument more.
That's a very unique perspective as an ambassador, you know, of our instrument to a different culture. Which you've been doing so well. I mean, we've gone over, and I think people are going to be excited because there's so much to discuss with you. We could go on to your younger career and stuff like that. There's so much. So maybe we'll get together at some point in the future.
Sure.
When you are building a spacecraft to take guitar to aliens, you find whatever's next for you. You know, thank you for everything that you've done for the guitar. You didn't need to do all this. You could have just settled down and been a professor like everybody else.
Yeah, you know, this is why I told you before. Sometimes I think, why did I do that? But to be honest, I mean, it's me, you know, I'm just, whether it's a good thing or not, it has good sides and not, I'm kind of an anxious person. I want some adventure in my life. Otherwise, I think I would just be so bored, maybe.
And then that can cause all sorts of problems. When we're bored, it's like, that's for me, being bored has cost me so many things. So I think you're doing the right thing, just trying to keep yourself occupied so that you don't end up.
It's been a great journey. And, you know, I mean, of course, at this point, I did so many different kind of things. People are not even surprised. Like you say, maybe spacecraft. And you'll be like, oh, yeah. It's almost like my path became to go always a different path with everything. Basically, every time we think, basically every day, try to take a new path. It's almost just became that way, you know, more and more. And it's almost like that became a path of itself just to do unexpected things. And like you say, a performer to create a guitar brand. There's several things. This is me, but it's also me having had these very unusual opportunities. Mm-hmm. But saying that, I've also been able to create very unusual opportunities, which is, if we're going to finish with something, if this is what if people ask me about, you know, how to go on about a career or what to do. It's very important to remember to not just rely on getting opportunity. You need to create opportunity, and you need to do it with many years ahead in sight.
Yeah.
You need to also create opportunity for yourself 5 years, 10 years ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So that, I mean, that's what you're doing. You're already kind of, you know, thinking about the future. Right now,
this is really quite interesting for anyone who's into writing. I do a kind of composition seminar every Sunday online.
Every Sunday?
So it's, I mean, three of those Sundays, it will be me. But then we have also guest teachers, like we had Dusan Bogdanovic for 4 months. And then we're getting Steve Goss to be a guest teacher in this. It's not really like composition lessons. It's more like what I call a seminar. It's more like you share your work and you can get feedback on it, of course. And I wanted to do a lot of stuff. I wanted to do more things online and all that. So it's been also opportunity to do that. But and I appreciate this interview too, because this is also a little bit what we miss now, I think, is feeling our community as guitarists.
Yeah.
With connection. But these things like, and I mean, you said you thanked me for my work, but you've done a fantastic work with this podcast for so many years. Thank you for doing that.
No, thank you very much.
It's, and it's important, definitely. More important maybe now than ever.
I think so. And I think that the people who've been writing me, there's a little bit more weight behind their, emotional voice. Mm-hmm. I've noticed it's a lot less like, hey, what's up? You know, it's a little more like,
it's more complicated. People feel very vulnerable. A lot of, especially for, I mean, I've been very affected because I used to perform so much, right? Yeah, so, right. But for a lot of people, a lot of people are worried. What is it going to be like? What is the future like? You know?
Yeah.
And so I think unfortunately some people get to really, oh, it will never be normal again. But I really don't think so. I think we will, this I know now because China has already regained completely now and things are just completely back to normal. They have performances. I would say to people, don't worry too much. Give it a few. It will actually be, but maybe I hope that it will maybe be better because I think to some degree we got a little bit, oh, a concert, you know, oh, another concert, you know, we do concerts and then people got so used to, you can hear music online. I hope now, especially for the Western world now, I hope that we will find back to the performance and we will reappreciate, is that a word? Yeah. Reappreciate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We will appreciate it more than we ever did before. This is what I hope.
I think that's a very big, there's a huge likelihood that that'll happen. There'll be a lot of smiling faces and, you know, I hope that it becomes that, like a sincere.
And maybe we learn to appreciate again, because to be honest, especially with classical guitar, before epidemic times, it was not so easy always to fill the halls, you know?
No, it certainly was. So I and hope now with 25% capacity.
Right. No, I mean, ironically, a lot of those concerts weren't affected because it was already just 25%. You know? Yeah. But I hope that once it comes back, then people will, all of you out there, this is what I hope is going to happen. We're going to storm out to go to our concerts and we're going to feel the concert halls, make the concert special again, you know, because that's what I saw. That's why I went to China so much, because their guitar is new. Making a concert is a special thing. People really, yeah, the Chinese people also love going out. The Westerners were too comfortable with TV and so on. The Chinese love going out. So I always thought they loved so much to go to the concert, even if it was a little messy. We're used to a more serious culture. But so I hope that would happen in the West now, that we will get that feeling. Yeah, let's just go to the concert. It's something really special. You can actually see a person for real playing music that is not pre-recorded. It's pretty awesome.
Make it more, you know, make it easier on the performers too when they aren't walking into a situation that's cold. You know, essentially people are out for the first time in year. When they go to America, you know, it's like their only concert ever. Well, thanks so much for joining me, Johannes. I had a wonderful time speaking to you. No problem. And hopefully the next time you're in New York, we'll
say hi. That would be super awesome. Yes.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Make sure you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. And of course, you can check out Johannes Moeller at his website. All of his guitars, all of his magnificent projects. Honored to have him on. Not too sure about who's going to be on next time. But also make sure you go to savageclassical.com. Tell him I sent you. Have a great and happy early spring, and I'll talk to you guys in a couple of weeks.